Hey everybody, it's Britt, lead pastor at Sunridge. Welcome back to our teaching podcast. You know, we are on a mission here at Sunridge to help people find and follow Jesus. We believe in the good news that Jesus welcomes all, regardless of how far you feel from God. That means we're a great starting point to explore Christianity or to sink your spiritual roots deep as a devoted Jesus follower. If you'd like to know more about us, just check out our website at sunridgechurch.org. And of course, we'd love to have you drop in anytime for a visit to learn and worship along with us. And now, here's our teaching for this week. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Sunridge Church on Sunday morning. Whether you're online or on campus, or you're brand new here, you just walked in and you're trying to figure things out, or you've been at Sunridge. Maybe some of you were born at Sunridge. I know that we've been, you know, we just experienced our 35th anniversary of being a church here in the Valley in September. So that is very possible that some of you were born here. I wanted to bring up one thing that we forgot to mention earlier is that every October we kind of redo our elder board. We have men and women that serve as kind of the human authority and leadership of our church. And you can give us input on those names. Basically, one a year rotates off so that we kind of keep our organizational history. And so C.J. Bramante rotated off this year, and Bill Spoolhoff is one of our new elders, and we would love to have your feedback on all of our board. There are sheets that you can give us those. Give us your feedback on in the back, or you can do it online. You know, as you get our weekly email, you can respond to that. Just scroll down, and you'll see a spot where we ask for your feedback. We'd really love for you to affirm these folks or tell us, you know, that you don't. We want your feedback. They're nominated from you, and you know, so, and they've gone through a rigorous process to get where they are. So just give us your feedback when you can. If you're new here, my name's Britt. I serve here as a lead pastor, and we've been in the study of Ezra and Nehemiah. We've been combining these two books. They give us a biblical or historical record of the Jewish people as they return to Judah and to Jerusalem. And you might, if you haven't been with us, you might wonder, well, why are they returning? Well, 70 years prior, they were banished or exiled by Babylon, who took them captive and took some of them as slaves and exported them off 800 miles away to Babylon, or left them in the decimated city. But under King Cyrus, they were able to return. And so they're there. And what we've seen thus far is the people that have returned are working through all the ordinary challenges of relocating, a massive relocation effort, and rebuilding their decimated city and restoring their spiritual lives and the spiritual traditions that they had lost in this conquering that had happened. And we've said that there's ordinary people living ordinary lives, but as has been mentioned 9 times in these two books, they had the hand of God upon them. And today we're going to see in chapter 5 of Nehemiah that a new challenge arises for the people, but this time it's one of their own doing. And it's an economic inequity forms amongst them. And it has all kinds of real life effects on the people, that, especially those that are standing on the lower rungs of society. And as Jordan just read, there was this economic crisis in Jerusalem. Some people were experiencing food shortage, and because of that, they were mortgaging their land holdings and their homes and their businesses just to feed their families. And some were forced to even borrow money at these exorbitant interest rates just to survive. And some were, even as Jordan read, were forced to placing their children into indentured slavery. So a new challenge for the people, but once again, it's very ordinary. If you look at it through our lens today, the people here are struggling with paying their taxes, making their bills, keeping a roof over their head. You're going to see some of these lights going cuckoo today. That's not like an evil spirit or anything. There's something wrong. It happened this morning, so just ignore it. Now that I've done that, none of you guys aren't going to pay attention at all. They're trying to maintain home ownership, feeding their families. They want future opportunity for their children. That's just everyday stuff that you and I face. So, but what I want you to see that I think is most noteworthy in chapter 5 is once this inequity is recognized, the way they respond. I want you to see the humble compassion of the people, particularly of those that are at the high end of the food chain. And then I want you to see the example of Nehemiah, how he leads through this. So here's what we're going to cover today in chapter 5. We're going to look at the problem that arose there in Jerusalem. And then we're going to look at how they face up to it. How do they deal with this? And then lastly, we're going to look at Nehemiah's example through all of this. And of course, as usual, we're always going to have some wrap-up ideas for you and I to consider about how we live today. So a big overview. First of all, we see this problem of economic injustice is in verses 1 through 5. Verse 1 says that Nehemiah becomes aware of, now the men and the wives raised a great outcry. This great outcry. And there's a couple of things that are notable right away about this statement. First of all, the wives are joining in. And in this day and time, women were kept silent. So the fact that women are also being, voicing this outcry of what's happening, it says how much, how desperate they are, what's going on with their families, and it tells you how bad it was. And then also what's notable is who their complaint was against. In verse 1, it says, against their fellow Jews. So what's up with that? What's going on? And verses 2 through 5 tells us that the food supply of the region couldn't keep up with this influx of all these people moving in. My home group talked about this last week. This whole situation, just picture this influx of all these people. It's the whole situation is exacerbated by all the people who are working on the wall. And so their time is being taken up doing that. And so their farms and their businesses are being neglected. Their jobs are being neglected. And now because the farms are being, kind of neglected, they have a food shortage. There's influx of a lot of people and less production. And so people are hungry. And then to add insult to injury, there's this heavy taxation that comes from the Persian government. And so they're selling off all their assets, their businesses, their homes, their properties, just so they could eat. Now that's very obviously a short-term solution, right? But even in what they're doing, inflation is eating up whatever profits that would come from their sales. And not only were they forced to leverage their businesses and their homes as collateral, as I mentioned, they had to put their children into indentured slavery. And now slavery then was not like the historic slavery that we have in that we had in America. It was heavy and it was indentured. But it was like people that could not pay their bills, their children would be placed into like servitude until through their service, their debt would be paid off and then they would be returned to freedom. And this is a terrible thing if you just think about it. It wasn't what they wanted to do, but they can see no other option. In verse 5, this is what the people say, we are powerless. We're powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others. Can you hear the desperation in that statement? And then here's the kicker, as we've already noted, it's not the surrounding pagan people that have opposed them over and over again and threatened them. They're not the ones that are making life difficult upon the people. It's their own people. Verse 1 says they're Jewish brothers. And so they're perplexed and they're frustrated by this. In verse 5, they say, look, we are of the same flesh and blood as our fellow Jews. And they can't figure out why everybody doesn't see this. They feel so devalued by their leadership. In verse 5, they also say, our children are as good as theirs. Now, that's evidence that this situation is not affecting everybody equally, right? Some were better positioned. They had deeper pockets. They had more influence and more power. You could say that the rich were getting richer and the poor were getting poorer.
Now, in your Bible, it is no sin, it's no crime to make a profit. But what's happening here is that some people are taking exorbitant profits during a time of economic crisis. And this is causing great harm to those that are less fortunate. They're exploiting their own people. And remember, all of these folks have returned to this region, to Judah and Jerusalem in particular, because they want to reestablish the city, their religion, their people, their history, and its past greatness. So in the mix here, you have two categories of people. You have people who are struggling just to put food on the table, and then you have opportunists who are thus far wealthy enough not only to be unaffected, but to exploit the situation. Aren't you glad that that would never happen today? So in verses 6 through 13, we see how Nehemiah and the other wealthy men and nobles respond. Verse 6, Nehemiah says, "When I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry." And this phrase, "very angry," means to burn, like it lit a fire inside him. Nehemiah already has this burning desire to restore his city as his heart for Jerusalem and his people. But this situation ignites a new passion in him, and he's going to do something about it. But even though this passion arises in him, he doesn't go off half-cocked. He doesn't fly off the handle, nor does he just, so he's not a reactionary, but he doesn't just ignore it and just like kind of like wave it off. In verse 7, he says that I pondered these things in my mind. Which means he stopped and he thought about it. And then he takes this step in response. He calls all the leaders and the nobles together, and he gets, because he wants to get everyone in the room so he can talk to them face to face. And he says, "I told them, you're charging your own people interest." Now, footnote here, in Judaism, it's lawful to charge interest. But the point was they were taking advantage of people. It's important to note here that this is completely legal, but it's not ethical, and it's not moral. Nehemiah is essentially saying, you're selling out your own people. In verse 8, the people that are at this gathering says they kept quiet because they could find nothing to say. Now, you know, just if you were in that room, you're like, maybe they're thinking, I've never seen Nehemiah like this. Man, he is fired up. Or maybe they knew he was right. And I think that most of them were sitting around, looking around in the room and taking the measure of what other people were doing. And then Nehemiah tells them in verse 9, what you're doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? He's saying, you're making a bundle of money and you're giving nothing back and you're hurting people and it's not right. Now here's a surprise in verse 10. Look what he says. I and my brothers and my men are also lending the people money and grain. But let us stop charging interest. Nehemiah has been doing the same thing. It doesn't say he was charging exorbitant amounts, but as part of the solution, he says, let's stop charging interest entirely. He then puts his money where his mouth is by proposing that they even make reparations here. In verse 11, he says, give back to them immediately their fields, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses, and also the interest that you've been charging them. So he's saying, give them back all those properties that you've acquired. Cancel their loans and return the interest you've charged. Crazy, huh? And then the nobles and officials comply. They say in verse 12, we'll give it back. And we will not demand anything more from them. We will do as you say. Now remember, like these people we're talking about, they're God followers. You know, Jesus isn't on the scene yet. But these are people who believe in Yahweh. And many of them, they have this special heart to not just to go back to this city that holds nostalgia for them, but to reestablish their spiritual life. So they've kind of gone through this spiritual revival. They're believers. But in the middle of even doing that, they've kind of like veered off, right? It shows you how easily this can happen to us. When they agree to stop charging interest and give things back, Nehemiah has them take an oath just to assure they don't renege on it later. Then just to put an exclamation point on it, he does this little enactment that the verses talk about. He shakes the folds of his robe. He stands before them and he shakes it as a symbol and a warning to say that any of you who break this commitment that we're making here, God will shake your prophets out. And at this, the whole assembly said, Amen, which means so be it. And they praised the Lord, and the people did as they had promised. Now, I bet you agree with me, like Nehemiah's a really good leader here. He has this huge crisis that he handles, and he's gotten all the players to agree. And then after they agree, he even established kind of an enforcement policy. He has a mechanism put in place that like holds people to their agreement. Don't you wish Nehemiah would run for Congress? But he does even more than personally confront this issue and come up with a solution to resolve this societal injustice. In verses 14 through 19, Nehemiah sets an ongoing or an outstanding example. And he flips the script here of how a person of power and wealth responds to hurting people. Previously, the way the world worked then, and some might believe that it still does, the powerful put themselves first. And they leverage their power and their wealth into more power and wealth. And then they create for themselves this very comfortable lifestyle. And at this time, all the governors of the regions were given a lavish allotment, lavish food, like all through taxation. But in verse 15, Nehemiah talks about this. He says, the earlier governors, those preceding me, placed a heavy burden on the people. And they took 40 shekels of silver from them in addition to food and wine. So they would take food and wine, drink, from people as taxation and also a financial taxation. And even their assistants lorded it over the people. It's like they were part of this too. So they had people who enforced this and also benefited from what was going on. But look what Nehemiah says here. But out of reverence for God, I did not act like that. The way it was done previously, the way that, like, if you got into this position, you were going to be taken care of. It was going to place a heavy burden on people, but you didn't have to worry about that because you were going to live this lavish lifestyle on their backs. That's the way it was done. But Nehemiah breaks with the status quo. Why? He said, out of reverence for God. And in verse 16, he says, instead, I devoted myself to the work on this wall. And all my men assembled there for the work. We did not acquire any land. Furthermore, 150 Jews and officials ate at my table, as well as those who came to us from the surrounding nations. And each day, one ox, six choice sheep, and some poultry were prepared for me, and every 10 days, an abundant supply of wine of all kinds. And in spite of all this, I never demanded the food allotted to the governor because the demands were heavy on these people. So Nehemiah refocuses efforts on the task God had given him. He stopped acquiring land, even when the opportunities arose. He used this daily food allotment that would come to the governor to feed others. And you see here, he kind of held a daily food bank, which was the best of the best for a wide range of people. It talks about other leaders, fellow Jews and officials, and even people that were from other nations, immigrants. Then in chapter 5, you know that Nehemiah, we've seen, is like a man of prayer, sometimes a very brief prayer, throws it up there. He prays this simple but profound prayer, and this is how the chapter ends. Remember me with favor, my God, for all I've done for these people. And in this prayer, we have this indication of the inner motivation that made Nehemiah so different. He is seeking God's favor over and above everything else. That's a key point here. Well, that's as far as we're going to go today. An inspiring chapter? What do you think? Inspiring leader? Yeah. What can we learn from this? And as I always say, it's like there's a lot of parallels that you may have already drawn in your own mind as we went through this chapter. But here's a few I see. First of all, I don't know about you, but this chapter makes me think about how some things never change. As good as life is, some people are still fighting these same issues. And in where we're born, if you live here in this country, we're super fortunate. We've done a pretty good job of leveling the playing ground, caring for the poor, making education and vocational skills available. But I think you'd also agree with me that we still have a lot of work to do. We still see the most vulnerable around us being affected by inflation, by the widening of wealth classes, the inability to own a home. We see injustice. We see very real consequences on the children that are stuck in that system. And we still see people who feel powerless to succeed. But I'm also thinking of all the other challenges that many people face that just make us feel powerless. For some of you, it's alcohol and drug addiction. For some, it's mental illness. Some of you are struggling in your marriage and you don't know what to do. Some of you are like, you know, I just think the world has gone crazy and I'm trying to raise kids that are godly and love Jesus. We still have the crushing weight of debt. Our national debt is higher than it's ever been. And in the midst of that, we have the dysfunction of government often. Sometimes, to me, it appears that the people that could enact real solutions fail to. Oftentimes because they're more interested in leveraging the issue to get a vote or to get money, or they're just so far removed from the struggle that the struggle of everyday people, it just doesn't touch them. There are still big problems. So I think that we can learn some things today about what a Christian can do in our situation. And I'm just going to give you, here's my big idea. The human struggles of today are not just social issues. They are gospel issues. They're gospel issues. What do I mean by that? The gospel, which means good news, transforms people, right? From the inside out. And that transformation is supposed to be so all-inclusive and so powerful that it changes us so much that we're capable of changing the most stubborn and difficult circumstances. It changes people, and those people, those change people, change the world. They change the lives of people. You know, Jesus said to his disciples, those that were transformed by the good news, like you and me, in Matthew 5, 14 through 16, you're the light of the world. Let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. And for the believer, there is no struggle, no issue, no societal ill that is so large that God cannot invade our hearts and our spirits and transform, have us transform that issue through the power of his Spirit and his people. If we see evidence of God's hand on Nehemiah in the way that he works and deals with injustice. They're not superheroes, these people. We've said that they're ordinary. But because they're God's people, they desired to be part of the solution. They realized that they weren't only called to rebuild city walls. but to rebuild justice in the city, to rebuild justice. The temple was completed, their homes were rebuilt, the city walls are being restored, but this thing that is less tangible and perhaps less obvious until someone pointed it out also required restoration, this thing called justice. And chapter 5 of Nehemiah, I believe, colors in what it means to be ordinary people that are doing ordinary things with the hand of God upon them. And so, as I wrap up, I have three ways that I think come out of this text that address for us as Christian people today how we can be part of rebuilding justice in our community and in the world. First of all, you have to hear the cries. You have to hear the cries. In verse 1, the author said, "Now the men and their wives raised this great outcry." Now let's be honest. It's easy not to hear the cries, isn't it? In this modern world, we see the whole world at once. It's overwhelming. If we're just saturated with what's going on in the world. Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, hurricanes. Sometimes we have a vested interest in keeping things the way they are. Ooh. Just seeing if you're paying attention. I got too many of my own problems right now. Not my circus, not my monkeys, you know. And we become calloused. We get hardened because, like, we're just used to it. And it's easy not to care. When Jesus announced his ministry and purpose in the synagogue in Nazareth, he stood up and he read from the scroll of Isaiah, and he said this in Luke 4:18, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And as his followers today, we cannot forget that carrying out his mission in the world means to alleviate suffering and to bring justice. When Jesus looked at the poor, he was moved in Mark 8:2, "I have compassion for these people, for they've already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat." We cannot let our hearts get so overwhelmed and so hardened to the struggle that people face. Verse 6 of chapter 5 says that Nehemiah heard their cries. And in verse 7, he says, "I pondered them in my mind," which means I consulted with myself. I mulled it over. And again, he didn't react. He didn't just discount it on the basis of the status quo. He thought about it. And the result of that contemplation is that it creates this reaction in his gut, deep in his being. It made him angry. He saw the injustice. This is not right. And it ignited a passion in his heart that was just as deep and meaningful as his passion to rebuild the city. What changed his perspective? What helped him to see it? He heard the cries. And then, as he processed that, what enabled him to have kind of like this breakthrough that no one else was having is, and this is the second thing, take God seriously. He took God seriously. And some of you are saying, "What? Wait a minute, Brett, I'm a Christian. Of course I take God seriously." But remember, at this time, early in the process, he's part of the problem. He and his brothers and other officials were charging the interest, making the most of their real estate opportunities that presented themselves. So here's what I mean. When Nehemiah confronted the rich nobles and officials who were taking advantage of the situation, this was a culturally accepted practice. It was legal. And he said to them, "Might be legal, but it isn't right." On the basis of something that superseded cultural acceptability. Here's what he said. Verse 9, "Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the approach of our Gentile enemies?" In other words, he was saying there are two things more important than what culture says, more important than what society says is right or wrong. And so these things supersede all legal and societal considerations. Number one, to walk in the fear of God. That's not necessarily walking around thinking that God's going to bring some retribution upon you or consequences, though it can include that. But more so, it's like the intentional awareness that as he walks, as he lives, he's living out the image of God and the society that he lives in. And two, he brings up this idea of avoiding the reproach of the Gentiles, which is all about God's reputation in the world. And so he says, I'm just so aware that I represent God. I'm made in his image. I represent God in this community. And I'm going to avoid any possibility that people would look at me and say, you know, you're just, what's different about you Jewish people from the Gentiles? You do the same thing that we do. In other words, just because it's legal or accepted or you can see other people doing it, those things in and of themselves aren't the final measure of what God desires. And that's like, look at how this comes out in Nehemiah 5:15. The earlier governors, those preceding me, placed a heavy burden on the people and took 40 shekels of silver from them, in addition to the food and wine, and their assistants also lorded it over the people. But out of reverence for God, I did not act like that. So here Nehemiah is saying this is socially accepted, it's a legal practice, that I'm going to cease. I realize now that I have to have a different approach to what's happening. Why? Out of reverence for God. And as the governor of this region, he's not testing the political winds, he's not checking the polls, he's not looking around to see what everyone else is doing. He's taking his relationship with God seriously. You know, James writes about this in James 2:14. What good is it, my brothers and sisters, if someone claims to have faith but has no deeds? Can such faith save them? Suppose a brother or sister without clothes and daily food is without clothes or daily food, and if one of you says to them, go in peace, keep warmed and well fed, but there's nothing about their physical needs, what good is it? What difference would it make in our lives, in this community, if out of a deep reverence for God, we started taking him seriously about the biggest issues of our day? This election, immigration, the war in Ukraine, in Israel, inflation and its causes, the poor. Are we taking God seriously in those big issues? Are we taking God seriously in these kind of like ordinary issues that we live day in and day out? Am I taking God seriously in my marriage? Am I really serving my wife out of reverence to Christ? Am I giving her the love and respect that she needs and she deserves as my wife? Am I generous? Do I take God serious about how I do my finances? Do I take God seriously about the way I do my job as unto the Lord, as we've talked about before? Do I take God seriously about my church? About loving my church and being part of this community in a way that it like makes me truly a part of this community? Am I taking God seriously in my daily conversation? The words that come out of my mouth. Do I really take God seriously, or am I just like finding my level based on what everyone else is doing around me? We need to hear the cries. We need to take God seriously. And last, to rebuild justice, we need surrendered living. Surrendered living. Nehemiah is a model of this. If we just summarize his actions, he's engaged in this acceptable and legal, typical practices of the day, and yet as God shows him the negative effect they're having on others, he stops. He stops that behavior and he leads others to follow him. And then through his own personal sacrifice, he turns this negative into a positive, and he turned around what was an acceptable profit to take and instead uses his bounty to help others to flourish. And once he had this awakening, he led by example. He worked side by side with others on the wall. And every day he had people at his table. But even in doing so, he says in verse 18, I never demanded the food allotted to the governor because the demands on these people were heavy. And I don't know about you, but that strikes me as such a deep and significant act of faith and surrender to God. It comes out of his reverence for God, that he's not just talking the talk, he's walking the walk. And then, of course, that chapter ends with this brief prayer, remember me with favor, my God, for all I've done for these people. He completely surrendered his rights to his God because he wanted his approval more than anything else. And you know, like from my vantage point, without that surrender, the problem of injustice in 4th century Jerusalem finds no solution. The Apostle Paul wrote, Galatians 2:20, I've been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. And Jesus said that he seeks not to please himself, but the one who sent him. That's complete surrender. I'm going to ask the band to come up, and I want to ask, are we a people surrendered to God? This is a gut check for all of us. Are we people willing to surrender something to God that is so precious to us, whether it be a privilege, a right, a lifestyle, a level of comfort, our time? And let me just take it off a we and put it on you and me. Are we willing to lay down our rights? Even those that are accepted in our day and time, if God calls us to do that, do we see the hurting people in our community, in our church? And does that make us think of, like, what is God's reputation in this? Do we think about the issues that we have today out of deep reverence for God? What would it look like in this nation, in our city, in our community, our neighborhood, if when we saw suffering, and we saw injustice, that we responded with compassion, that we heard their cries, and then when that became aware to us, we responded to it out of a deep reverence for God, and then we surrendered our rights, the things that are, we have every right to just continue doing and not concerning ourselves with. But we did that because we wanted God to receive glory. You see, we have more than walls to build. We have justice to rebuild. And there's still places in the world where that needs to be done. And I think that Nehemiah has given us a great example and a great pathway in order for us to do it. Let's pray. God, we are open to what you might want to do through us as individuals, our family, our church, a group of friends. When we see injustice in the world, it's so easy to grow comfortable with it, become accustomed to it, to kind of be numb to what we see, and to follow a path of that doesn't lead us to compassion or to bring hope, to just kind of be apathetic, to blame, to be angry. And yet, Nehemiah's example, the Spirit of Christ in us, tells us that we have to have eyes of compassion, and that our foremost and most important goal is to bring you honor, to have a deep reverence for who you are as God, and to surrender ourselves completely to the calling that you've given us, whether it's to rebuild a wall, to rebuild justice, or to rebuild our marriage, or to do something in our community, or just to make someone know that you love them. You open our eyes, open our hearts, and move our feet and our hands. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you for listening, church. Let's stand and worship together.
Hey, everybody, it's Britt again. Thanks for listening. If you need something, if you have a question, or you'd just like us to pray for you, you can reach us through email, info@sunridgechurch.org. We hope you'll listen in again next week, but in the meantime, keep helping people find and follow Jesus.